Today is October 28, 2016. I am local historian Tom Arnold interviewing Dr. Richard Sapp and Mrs. Phyllis Sapp at the Lawrence Public Library in Lawrence, Kansas for the City of Lawrence Fair Housing Ordinance 50th Anniversary Oral History Project. At the time the ordinance passed in July 1967, Richard was a professor on the faculty of the University of Kansas, and Phyllis was active in community organizations such as the Lawrence League of Women Voters. To start off, I'd like to have both of you tell me a little bit about your backgrounds and what you were doing in Lawrence in the 1960s.
You go ahead.
We came to Lawrence in 1957 when I got a position with the University of Kansas in the Physics and Astronomy Department. And that was just at the end of the era when Will Chamberlain had made some inroads in the civil rights areas by the sheer size of his presence, such as integrating barbershops and movie theaters. A big issue right after we came was the swimming pool. There was a private pool called the Jayhawk Plunge down on 6th and Florida Street, and it was open only to members, white members, was understood. And an attempt was made to try to integrate that pool, and instead it was closed. And so the city was doing without a public pool at that time. And later there was a temporary one down in the south part of town before the swimming pool complex was constructed downtown. I was invited to participate in the picketing and protesting at the plunge, but I had just arrived in town and didn't have a firm grasp on the local politics by any means, and I also felt I didn't have any tenure at the university, and I just didn't want to stick my head out at that time. Later, of course, I was on more firm footing, and then I could participate in these things that I wanted to.
Yeah. Well, I came because Dick came. We'd just been married a few months before, but we knew each other at Ohio State University, where I did my undergraduate work and Dick did his graduate work. And I was very happy to move west from Ohio. I grew up in northern Illinois, and my parents had come from South Dakota, so I always felt that going west was best. And happy to move out here. I had been to Lawrence once with a group from Ohio State coming to a conference, so I liked the place. And I liked the fact that it was near a city. That's been a big advantage, or two cities, actually. But Dick's right about the swimming pool. I don't remember it was members only, because I actually went there with a neighbor or friend asked me one time, and I wondered about this, but I decided I would go and see what it was like when that great a swimming pool for that matter. So after that, we did not participate in it, and we didn't go to any pool unless it was open to the public until the one downtown was opened. We would not join a swimming pool, and our children remember that. It was one of their first lessons, or one of their early lessons, and, you know, everyone needs to have access to these public, what should be public, like the pool.
Right. And I'll come back to the swimming pool. I've got a question about that later, particularly in what involvement you may have had in the effort to get the bond issue finally passed after the Fair Housing Ordinance passed the same year, but later. When you arrived in Lawrence in those early years, how did the racial environment, the climate of racial relations strike you? How did the degrees of discrimination, segregation strike you as compared to what you may have been used to and the attitudes that you had grown up with in Ohio?
I moved to Ohio when I was about 14. It was pretty usual. Well, no, it was worse than in northern Illinois, very near Wisconsin border. There wasn't much said about at least about black, white kinds of things. I know there was discrimination against Jews to a small extent anyway, at least talk about it, but not, I don't think, excluded, at least not from anything I knew about it. Of course, I was pretty young and I didn't know about things like country clubs and that kind of thing. So when we moved to Columbus, southern Ohio, I was taken aback by some of the segregation. And particularly in our high school, we had a black fellow who was very active and well-liked. We went on a senior class trip to Washington, D.C., and he was not allowed to eat in the cafeteria where we were eating. Mm-hmm. I've always regretted that I went into the cafeteria. I guess I didn't know what to do at that point, because I remember one of the teachers staying out with him, and I don't know where they went to find some food. That shocked me. Hmm. So that was part of the whole thing.
Right. And Richard, how did you find Lawrence compared to what actually, your experiences growing up?
My small hometown in southwestern Ohio was very much like Lawrence when we came.
Okay.
It was understood that blacks had to use certain facilities and not others. A certain area in the theater where they could sit, but not others. All that kind of thing was very familiar to me, and I didn't like it. I never liked it, but I had never really taken any public stance against it up to this time.
Right. To describe Lawrence a little bit, what you found once you came here, you've already mentioned the inroads that Will Chamberlain, some of the KU athletes made, and also the swimming pool issue. What other aspects of discrimination or segregation in Lawrence struck you at that time as being, you know, particularly objectionable? Was housing segregation quite obvious?
Well, it certainly was there. It was very much so. Fairly obvious, I think, yes. And I think there was still some segregation in the theater. Well, I don't know in the theaters, really, or in some of the public places like this, because I think with Wilt coming, they got the theaters desegregated. The restaurants, I'm not really... Well, we didn't have that many restaurants. In fact, Lawrence was really... When we came here, Lawrence had something like 27,000 people, which to me was very small. Mm-hmm. Because I'd always lived in bigger cities. And I don't know the kind of restaurants that were here. I don't really know too much about that. But, yeah, and we kept hearing about segregation. And this Lawrence League for the Practice of Democracy had started working against segregation and toward integration and what could be done there. It made a person, well, it made me very indignant to see people not able to buy homes as such. Now, this is getting toward the ordinance and what we did for that, so maybe Dick wants to speak.
Well, I was just going to comment that this is leading right into our first kind of involvement. We think it was somebody in the League of Women Voters who told us about a program of white people visiting in Negro people's homes in Lawrence and talking about their experience with housing segregation. So we went to one of these meetings at James and Elizabeth Cheeks' house, C-H-I-E-K-S,
near the hospital.
It was, it was over in that area near the hospital.
Okay.
And there were six or eight of us visiting there, and they simply talked about their experience in trying to buy a house where the they saw a realtor, and he told them where he could show them a house in Lawrence, and it was only in areas where black people already lived. Essentially redlining.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we've we've heard. It's been described by several people to us.
So that really fired up my feeling. You know, this is very unfair, and led on to our other activities.
Right. How about your own neighborhood where you all lived? Was it
all white?
All white. Yeah.
All white.
Yeah, pretty much the surveys that were done at the time showed that most of the neighborhoods were either
North Lawrence, East Lawrence,
some hospital
in the Northwest.
Right, kind of Pinckney and parts of Old West Lawrence neighborhood. But even within those neighborhoods, usually it was confined to a block or two where they tended to be congregated. Any other forms of discrimination that were apparent? Employment discrimination? If you went to a store downtown, would you most likely find only white clerks and most of the stores? Or
I would say so.
What would you say, before I get into it, I don't want to talk to you about not only what motivated you all to get involved, which you've already touched on, but also talk about kind of what motivated other people that you recall. But what do you think were the major impediments to bringing about changes to those things? I mean, were there, and I don't expect you to name names, but groups or local interests that were opposed to change that you can remember?
Oh, yeah.
Well, this about this time in the middle 60s was when there was a fair housing bill in the Kansas legislature. And people in Lawrence were amazed to find that the fight against that bill was led by realtors from Lawrence for agencies sent people over there to testify against it. I could name some names, but it's probably not important anymore.
You can probably find those names in the newspaper if you want to go look for them.
And so, again, that was motivation for us to try to do something better here, since we were not going to get it on the state level, apparently.
Right, right. So would you say, and I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but was part of the motivation of moving forward to pursue a local ordinance the disappointment with the fact that the state wasn't taking action?
Yes, definitely. The Human Relations Commission had been formed around 64. You probably have the date better than I do.
A little bit earlier than that, I think, about a year after the swimming pool, but 61, 62 time frame.
Okay. Okay.
But they really didn't become a very active organization, I would say, until probably 64 and after.
All right. Yeah. So people there took up the cause, and the League of Women Voters had helped or encouraged the Human Relations Commission to get started. And I just don't remember who specifically set up this program where we could go and visit at the Cheeks or at someone's house and hear firsthand what their experiences with housing were. But I think it was probably arose out of the study that the League of Women did. They always, and they still do, research and study an issue. We'll take a stand on issues, not on political candidates. So I can't say exactly, but it was a small, it wasn't that a huge number of people did this, but I think there were several groups that did this. And it just was so powerful to hear people actually, you know, say, I was not allowed to buy a house anywhere but here or here or here. And they had the money. This was not low-cost housing necessarily. This was people who were what we might say middle class economically, and they could have afforded a house in other areas.
Right.
I also, this probably should come later, but I will say that in our neighborhood, on our street, we had a couple of black families move in after the ordinance.
Oh, that's good, because we've tried to get a sense in some of the interviews as to whether people saw change come about, and I know often change comes about slowly, but that is something I'd like to raise with you to kind of get a sense of how apparent change was after the ordinance was passed. Yeah, actually, in the probably 64-65 time frame, the NAACP did a housing survey, and they found that of all the new neighborhoods built since the early 1950s, not a single black family resided in any of them. And I think then at the time the ordinance was passed, somebody else had done a survey and found by then there was only one African-American family in all those neighborhoods, so it hadn't changed much in that time. The United Church Women of Lawrence did a housing survey and I think did some housing visits and gathered signatures in support of fair housing. The League of Women Voters, I know, did their own study. So there was quite a bit of interest and activity. Now, we've already touched on a little bit, but a group that actually started looking into it even earlier was that League for the Promotion of Democracy. Were the two of you involved in that organization?
We were not members of that Lawrence League for the Practice of Democracy. We did know about it. We were told about it when we moved here, and I think we were just getting into the community and into the university and what was going on, and that then into the League of Women Voters, which had many of the same members in these groups. So we were not actually members, but we certainly supported. They were the very first grassroots.
Right. They actually started in 1946, and the story is in their own little history that they wrote that it came about because an African-American World War II veteran had come back to Lawrence after fighting in the war and was ejected from a movie theater in Lawrence because he wouldn't sit in the colored-only section, and that upset enough people that they formed that group to start fighting discrimination. So you've talked a little bit about what motivated the two of you to get involved in these types of groups and to work on bringing about these kind of changes. Can you kind of generalize other people you were involved in? What kind of motivated them in general? And was there a pretty significant involvement of the university community in that? Were they particularly active, some of your colleagues? And
Yes, I would say.
I'd say a big part of it was from the university. The university people didn't worry about their customers. They had the customers, the students. They didn't worry about losing their jobs. Or losing friends, for that matter. Right. I mean, there would be some, but, you know, I'm going to reinforce what a lot of people think, that university people who work and teach at university are liberal, and at least in these views.
Right, and generally far more diverse because they've come from all parts of
the
country.
This is very true. As I said, my experience of, I'm sure where I grew up in Rockford, Illinois, there was no blacks were able to sit anywhere in the theater. I don't remember a thing about being segregated. So all this was a surprise. Not a surprise, but, you know, just foreign to me, different.
Another source of my motivation was that in the middle 60s, we had become members of First Methodist Church. I became first a member and then the chair of the, what they called the Committee on Social Concerns. And so I was sort of casting around for a direction to lead some activity in the area, in that area, and fair housing popped up on my horizon. Partly through that. So when I went to the Fair Housing Coordinating Committee, I was recognized as a representative of a fairly substantial church in town.
Okay, very good. So that was kind of your entree into the to that organization. And I was going to ask you about the churches, because we've also found that there was quite a bit of activism coming out of a number of churches, and certain churches in particular. Plymouth Congregational Church had a social action committee. Yeah. I think the Unitarian Church had one.
Yeah, so, Unitarians were active. Yeah.
So would you say that the churches were very much kind of provided a foundation of support in addition to really university people in trying to bring about change?
Yes, and I would imagine some of the names on this list here are people connected with the black churches in town.
Right, right.
Well, I would also say, though, about churches, there were a number of people who I'm sure were not as enthusiastic about it. We did not have everybody agree on things in the church. And we really didn't stay with, well, we stayed with the church for a while, but got a little not so happy with how some of the attitudes.
Okay.
I can illustrate it. The way pressures could be brought to bear to people who didn't have protections. Young man who was local manager of a savings and loan on Ninth Street, it was Anchor Savings and Loan, his wife wrote a letter to the editor in the journal World in support of fair housing. And some of these realtors came to his office and said, "Shut your wife up, or you've lost our business."
Wow. That's an eye-opening story.
Yes.
I've actually heard a similar story from one of the other people I interviewed about a visit that he actually personally got by people who didn't like some of his activities. Would you say then, following up on that, that there was towards the university people, towards especially the ones who were involved in bringing about change through the churches, that there was a degree of resentment among certain segments?
Certainly resistance.
Resistance.
And who did that primarily come from? And again, don't mention names necessarily, but who did it come from, and kind of what were their motives in fighting change other than just an acceptance of this is the way it's been, don't rock the boat?
Oh, they were afraid of losing business, business people who own restaurants or stores or things like this. And what else would you say? I would say just like this, the realtors themselves brought up, I thought, rather specious arguments, but it was important to them. They felt, I'm sure they felt somebody else would get the business if they gave into this. And one of the very valuable things about having a law, we found, was that the realtors found, was that they could say, this is the law, to people who are selling homes. You know, you don't have a choice of who you sell to. And they found that actually it worked in their favor.
Right.
We heard that from a man who'd been very much against the law and within a couple of years was very much for it.
That's an interesting point. Do you recall any, as you started getting involved and working on the fair housing issue, do you recall any particular individuals who played kind of important leadership roles who stood out as having, taken on particularly prominent roles in helping to mobilize support?
Well, Glenn Kaffelman, who was I know you've heard him, a realtor, and he was very much for equal rights, for fair housing. He stayed with the realty board and worked from the inside. This is how he put it, and we found that that was very valuable. Instead of, quitting and saying, well, I don't like your attitudes, he worked Glenn was very good at talking with people, and he had patience, and where I would tend to say become it quite indignant, he would be much more patient with it. So I think Glenn was one of the most valuable people that we had working with this, because he was involved with the business community. I'm sure he was a member of the Chamber of Commerce, all that kind of thing. Who else, Dick, would you say?
I think Reverend Dick Doolin was useful as chair, because he was pretty much not subject to any pressures, although he was only associate pastor and so forth. But he was, as I recall, he was very calm person, and kind of kept us focused and moving toward objectives, and he was a good leader.
Good. Since you bring up his name, and he, of course, was the youth, or I think the campus minister at Plymouth Congregational Church, so you're right, he wasn't necessarily under any particular pressure from even maybe so much from the congregation itself, but as the head of the Fair Housing Coordinating Committee, he obviously played an important role in that group. But describe the Fair Housing Coordinating Committee to me, how it, you recall that it came about, who the members were, what organizations sort of supported it and were involved with it, as best you can recall.
We were not involved with it at its inception, so we don't know about that at all. The the list of people who were members in 1966 pretty much identifies the groups who are being represented there, if you know who the people are.
Right.
Well, okay, and Moore. Tom Moore was with the KUY, I don't think we even called it YMCA, YWCA. I had been involved with the YWCA when we came here, the campus one. And then it became a joint one, and Tom was hired with that. And Tom and Ann were Quakers, friends, and that, with all the attitudes that go along, and very good in the community. Again, patient, kind people working that way. Reverend Lewis Branch was black.
The church at New York, 9th and New York,
St. Luke's?
St. Luke's.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was a black church, and that's still, of course, going on. The churches are still very much black or white,
I'd say. Right,
right. The Stanfields were black couple.
They were members of that church, yeah.
And Ben Hanen was pastor of the First Christian Church,
okay.
and his wife. Dorothy Adams was the wife of a professor at KU, and I'm not sure what other things she did, but she was very active in the community. So, and Jean Shaw was too. Ed Shaw was at KU. We women who didn't have paying jobs did a lot of League of Women Voter type things and other work. I don't remember Jim Griffiths. Do you, Dick?
No.
A reverend. Mike Marr was at the university and was very active in these kind of things. Petey Cerf and Mrs. Raymond Cerf, Ann Cerf, was involved with all kinds of things.
Tell me a little bit about her. Her name comes up quite a bit as a real leader in the early 60s.
Well, she had a forceful personality. I wouldn't say that she got mad. I'm sure she did get mad about things, but she didn't show it in that way, but she was forceful, and when she talked about something, you listened and you heard. I liked her tremendously, and most well, I don't know that most people did, but most people who were on her side or right. felt she was on their side. She got a lot of things started and done, and she did have some financial, was in a financial position to put money toward some things, too. So she got a number of things going in town.
Good. Had she been a longtime Lawrence resident?
She certainly had been here a while when we came, and I don't know when they came. Her husband
was at the university.
Yeah, top five. Wasn't he a violin?
Musician. Raymond Cerf. Cello.
Cello.
Okay. So she was involved in community organizations.
And her son, William Dan, is involved in things now, more financially than anything else right now. I see his name on various things. I don't really know him.
Right.
He writes, or at least he was all right. It's in the trenchant letters to the editor in the journal world.
Well, Petey died a number of years ago. I can't tell you when. It's just that she's still a presence.
Right. Yes, as I said, her name has come up. Mm-hmm. Fred Six said that she played an early leadership role, spurring action by a number of people.
She also lived near where we live.
Okay.
Which meant I saw something of her, I guess. Marion Boyle, her husband was in the art department at KU, and didn't know her real well. I think she worked at Haskell for a while, and then at KU, too, with students. With students needing tutoring, needing help, students who were disadvantaged, I guess we might say. Howard Rosenfeld.
Yeah, history professor.
Yeah. And Lee Ketzel, who's been involved in all kinds of things. I'm sure you've come upon her name. And she's someone you could interview, I'm sure. I talked with her the other day to see what she remembered about the voters. She's doing a lot still in the community. Great. Ada Swineford.
Leaving at
the university. She was at the university, but she left to go to Washington State, so she didn't do a whole lot. And I don't know Reverend John Ayers.
I think the list makes pretty clear that the religious institutions and the university provided a lot of the...
Right, exactly. And then, so really, the university community, the church community, and then groups like the League of Women Voters, United Church Women, which I'm sure there was a lot of involvement of people between among those groups, the NAACP.
Now, Dorothy Keltz.
She was on the Human Relations Commission.
I don't know. Her husband wasn't at the university, I don't think. You see all these people who had to watch what they said and did because of business.
Forget what Keltz's job was.
Harold Keltz.
Hal
Keltz.
He was not at the university, but...
And she was very active, so that would be somebody...
Right, and I think she was actually on the Human Relations Commission at the time the ordinance came up. She was in charge of their little housing subcommittee, so she was probably very...
I know that she was involved.
So obviously she had been involved with housing.
That would be very interesting to know what her husband did, just in light of this, was there pressure... I certainly didn't see any pressure that she felt.
I can probably go back and find that out. Just for the record, for the transcribers, I just want to, because I can't remember if we mentioned it when you first started reading the list you just read was of members of the Fair Housing Coordinating Committee in 1966.
Yes, as of April 25th, 1966.
Okay.
It says beginning list of interested persons, actually, rather than members, but beginning list of interested persons. So that's when it was just getting formed.
Well, somewhere in our collection, I found a letter I had written to Dorothy Keltz expressing my personal opinions about the need for fair housing. And it's just now become apparent why I wrote her on that subject.
And the other thing, interesting thing that this brings to light is, and I had asked a couple of people previously and they just weren't sure, but was there, before the Fair Housing Ordinance proposal was even brought to the Human Relations Commission by the Fair Housing Coordinating Committee, had there been some interaction between Human Relations Committee members and the committee talking about this beforehand, then it sounds like if she was involved both in the
I'm sure there
subgroup,
was because yeah, you, suspect yeah. so. There was so much go between
right.
Between them. The League of Women Voters sent observers to various city commissions and committees and such, and Lee Ketzel was one of the observers at the right. Human Relations Commission.
So let me ask you, why fair housing of all the, you know, employment discrimination, the swimming pool issue, the schools and educational opportunities of all the different things, why did so many people seem to coalesce at that time around the fair housing issue? Do you have a sense of that?
I think that the people who were being discriminated against brought it to our attention. Somehow, that it really did. This we were aware of it in various ways, but this going to the Cheeks home and having them say, you know, we can afford a house other places, but we were only allowed to buy over here by the hospital or one of those other places. It was so unfair.
Right.
So, yeah. And perhaps maybe a little easier to work on than employment is such a great, huge, big issue.
Yeah, well, Devin,
I tried to do something about
Discrimination and segregation was such a huge, massive problem. An individual needed some focus, a right. place to enter it. Fair housing seemed like one of them, but we quickly realized, you know, jobs, education, there are other very important things.
Right.
But this was something that we could address directly, so that's where we focused our attention.
Sure.
And certainly now we're realizing so much about low-cost housing.
Oh, that was so interesting. It came up with our recent meeting that they quickly leaped beyond housing discrimination to the problem of
the meeting
affordable
at the
housing, which has been
right.
a problem in Lawrence ever since.
Right, yeah. Lawrence has always been, as I understand it, one of the more expensive communities in Kansas.
The younger people who weren't involved with this, you know, took on that, which is very good. I'm glad people are taking on it because I think that's very important too. And I don't know. Well, I think the city and county need to have a fund.
Well, there seems to be some activity in that area.
Right.
So,
and it's actually interesting. What a thought that crossed my mind when that woman brought it up at that program we attended. That there is a lack of affordable housing for older people and someone who's disabled like her. But I can actually recall in reading some of the history of the work being done towards fair housing, there were at least some voices at that time, and I'm not sure anything really got traction to work on it, but who expressed concern about affordable housing, particularly for older retired people in lower incomes, being a problem. So clearly that's been on people's agendas for a very long time.
So many things came in. The nursery schools for children or pre-kindergarten education came up also in the early 60s. Now, Jesse Milan, have you heard about
him? We interviewed Jesse last Friday.
Oh, and, wonderful. He and his wife are terrific people. And Alversa was very much involved with getting the first nursery school for low income, the Children's Hour is called. And a number of us worked on it. Hilda Enoch was one of the people who helped get that started, and Alversa, Milan, and the ideas came and the need was certainly there. So some of us got to work. I remember interviewing people.
Jesse Marlin ran for the city commission more than once. We supported him strongly, tried all ways to get him on. In the preliminary primary voting, he was always first. But then in the general election, he was always fourth out of three to be chosen.
Right.
Yeah. It was very discouraging for them and for us, for all, I mean, all kinds of the people who wanted him. And they eventually moved back to Kansas City. I'm sure he told you about
all of this. Jesse's role in Lawrence is really fascinating. I mean, not only being the first African-American teacher, but then I guess he became, I think, the assistant director of youth programs for the city's park and recreation system, and really fought for a lot of causes, but took a lot of heat from people who didn't like the leadership role he was playing and the kind of changes he was trying to bring about. And he says, I probably wouldn't have lasted as long as I did in this town, except for some of the students I had taught and their parents, white students and white parents, who kind of helped protect me. When a lot of other people were very much against
it. He did so much good for kids, for children who had problems, physical problems. He would work with them. Right. Well, and all and the kids loved him. He was there with our kids, and, you know, he was just so good with them. So good with people. Such a good... They were a wonderful family, and terrible that they were accepted. Right. I mean, nowadays, they would just be part of everything.
Yeah, and they were absolutely themselves victims of housing discrimination when they tried to move up to larger houses.
Yeah, sure they were.
Yeah.
It's... But they help bring about change by being who they are. I brought up that about the nursery schools because that tied in with then with getting into housing too.
Right,
the whole thing, the education part.
There were certainly arguments made at the time, and I think you can still make very good arguments. And I think Robert Cassad's article that was published in February 67 made the argument that, to a significant extent, housing is the root. If you segregate everybody into one area, that means they all go to the same, what generally turn out to be substandard schools.
Right.
Their employment opportunities tend to be limited because there may not be as many jobs available in that area. So often integrating housing opens up opportunities, and so that's sometimes the best place to start.
That's another thing with lower cost housing because of job opportunities, and one of the reasons that we got the bus system started.
Right.
And I don't think I worked on that, but to have a bus system so people could get from where they do live to where the jobs are, one of the most important parts of having the bus system. And certainly in those days, that would have been a problem.
Sure. Well, up to now, we've kind of talked about background, so let's jump into focusing a bit more on the process for bringing the Fair Housing Ordinance to the Human Relations Commission and then getting it passed. Do you recall, again, I think we talked about this a little bit earlier, but what sort of drove the timing? And I think actually in December 1966, Reverend Doolin signed out a letter to whoever was the mayor of Lawrence at the time saying, you know, I'm representing the Fair Housing Coordinating Commission. We intend to bring a proposal for a fair housing ordinance to the Human Relations Commission. And then at their first meeting in early January, in fact, I think probably was a record attendance, 60-some of you attended that Human Relations Commission meeting in which the idea for the ordinance was proposed. Do you remember what drove the particular timing of it in late 66, early 67?
Well, the state
ordinance up the heat.
Okay.
I don't know how long it took.
Not long.
But it wasn't very long. We sat in the Fair Housing Coordinating Committee and talking about this, and I finally said, let's go to the city commission and try to get them to do something.
Get something local we can't get.
Yeah, yeah.
And it went fast. What, took 6 months? It's July they passed
the ordinance? Right, yeah, from the 4th of January it was presented to the Human Relations Commission and passed in the middle of July, so that was pretty impressive.
And the people on the HRC, like Fred and others, you know, got the information and got the thing written in record time, I would say.
And was your impression that the Human Relations Commission was quite receptive to the idea and very interested in helping you move it forward?
Yes.
Good.
I have a quote from that time nobody else seems to remember, but I do very clearly. the mayor at that time, Dick Rainey.
Yep.
Rainey, the younger Rainey, commented when the ideas were presented. He said, "You know, I've never understood why realtors have any right to tell us where we can live." Hmm.
That was at the meeting where it was passed.
So when he was there at the recent meeting, I reminded him about that. He didn't remember it.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting how some things stand out in your mind and you recall and for somebody else.
It impressed us because he was a businessman. His father's a businessman.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, Jim Owens is another businessman who was involved with all this. He had the floral shop.
And he was on the human relations. Had been on the city commission, but by then was on the human relations commission.
Right.
So it comes up to the Human Relations Commission in January. They're very receptive and start obviously researching and drafting. And who do you recall kind of played the main role in pulling it together?
Well, I'm not sure, except Fred was so involved, but I'm sure
Fred
it was
Six.
Fred Six, but I'm sure I think they virtually all worked on it, and I'm not sure how much the coordinating committee did from then
on. I don't remember.
I think
it seemed almost like it just needed somebody to say, let's move ahead.
Yeah,
let's do it.
Professor Cassad was involved, and I think he had been involved with the Fair Housing Coordinating Committee, although when I interviewed him, he didn't remember being heavily involved. He sort of had the impression he was kind of brought in
expertise. I think he came in for expertise, think he had the right. Yeah, he could have been involved, but not everybody could be active.
As the Human Relations Commission was working on the ordinance, a couple other things were going on the side that the Fair Housing Coordinating Committee seemed to have been orchestrating. One was the 7 articles that were published in the Journal World in February.
That was my idea.
Was it?
Tell
me about that.
University professor to get some experts to tell about things.
What was your intended audience, or who were you hoping to influence by those articles?
Anybody with a reasonable mind.
Right. But were you hoping...
The thinking public.
Yeah, this was hoping that kind of the general public would therefore be convinced that they shouldn't oppose this, or was it targeted at the city commission to try and them pressure?
General
public? Okay.
The last article, the one by the sociologist Jack Barr, I remember, he said that it would be good if we could progress past these discriminations, but he says, but it'll take a long time with human people being what they are.
Right. Yeah. And sadly, we're still seeing some truth to that.
Yeah.
I remember you're contacting people.
I know. Some of the first people I thought of contacting, said, well, I'd like to have some ideas in this area, but I don't think I can stick my neck out at this time.
That's interesting. So you actually reached out to people you thought would be good candidates to author these articles, and some were more receptive than others.
Well, as I say, they were just felt like they were subject to pressures.
But enough people did. Although when I go back and read them, I think those are learned articles, very well written. But I wonder if the man on the street or the woman on the street, so to speak, paid a lot of attention to it because they were... just written in a more professorial or just for an audience that. But we needed to get the people who were thinking people who would say, well, yes, this is right. And if so-and-so, if enough other people are doing it, I'll join in.
Right.
We won't feel the pressure of there 10 of us instead of 1 or 100 instead of 10 or whatever.
And I think the list of authors also illustrates the importance of the religious and educational communities within Lawrence.
The university has had such a big impact on Lawrence because, as I say, when we came, Lawrence was something like 27,000, and the university had 12,000 students.
Mm. Yeah, Lawrence really was a small town.
You know, the university has always been a really important part of Lawrence in all kinds of ways, providing employment for not only people who are teaching there, but all these people who help in one way or another. And so it has a big influence, really. And right. Some people view it negatively. I've run into that. Yeah. I used to. I don't anymore.
Yeah, Fred Six, when I interviewed him, he said that he did not think that that kind of change could have been brought about at the time if Lawrence wasn't a university town, mm-hmm. and the diversity and more freer thinking that university people brought to challenge things that they thought were wrong.
I remember when Leonard Clark and his then fiance, later wife, came to the first meeting and told about their problems trying to rent an apartment where the apartments were advertised in the paper, but when he went, he was told they were all taken, but the advertisement continued in the paper. I said to him, I said, Leonard, you're in a position to embarrass this town.
Yeah, another university couple that we've been told also suffered discrimination. Unfortunately, we've been trying to track them down to interview them. But did you know Bob and Gladys Sanders?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I can.
They moved back to Carolina. They're in North Carolina. Fairly recently.
Right. We've been trying to.
Do you have their address and phone number?
The city does, and the city has. Well, if you have their phone number, that would be great. The city has mailed them at their new address and emailed them, but has not heard back.
I know who does, surely.
Okay, if you could get that for us, that would be great. Because I'm actually, as I said, I'm hoping to go back and interview Reverend Doolin.
They came after Fair Housing. Well, they came in the 70s, didn't they? And the physics department had two black professors come. Okay. Or one was a graduate. I guess he was graduating, but he'd been teaching. He wasn't a real young person. And they were great, really good people and all. And one of the black families who lived on our street was Marilyn. I can't say her last name. She was a law professor.
Okay.
And these people didn't stay too long. And you know why? Because they were offered more money at other places.
Sure.
Because there were not that many minority professors or people qualified to teach, and all the universities and colleges were trying to diversify their faculties,
right,
and
right.
were under pressure too.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
physics black professor was quickly lured away by the federal government for some sort of black education project. Paid him a lot more than
yeah, the pay goes right. And you can't blame the people.
Sure.
Either. But the Sanders, yes, they did stay here, and Bob taught in some form of biology.
He was in microbiology.
Microbiology.
Something in the biosciences.
Well, Gladys
taught math.
Well, she taught math at the high school.
Yeah.
Yeah, or junior high school. But not at first. They came and they lived in the Sunflower duplexes, which was where we had lived for several years when we first came here. And they had two children, Sylvia and William. I think they had Sylvia when they came, but William was born after they came. Yeah, we knew them quite well for a number of years, and then kind of the university grew so much, and a lot of other people, you kind of ended up in more your area, like the physics, astronomy,
right.
chemistry people. And just because it was so big, you didn't see the other people. We're very active with the retirees group at KU now, the Endicott Society. And one of the wonderful things about it is getting reacquainted with people from all areas of the university. But anyway,
I don't even know everybody in my own department now.
Gladys is very forthright. And she's a very good artist, too.
Well, I hope we can get a hold of them and see if they'd be willing, because while I'm back in North Carolina interviewing the Doolins, I would love
that would be great. Them as well. I think they would. I really do. And I will get the phone number.
And even if they ended up, if they came a little bit later, it would be still be interesting to see what their experience was post fair housing ordinance as compared to pre-fair housing ordinance.
I'm not sure when. I thought it was.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and
after
look.
After 70, but it, no, wait a minute. Oh, I'm trying to think of from the ages of our children. It must have been in the later 60s because our kids were born in 61 and 63, and they were still fairly young. It was it before we went to Berkeley or after? That was a Dick had a sabbatical, and we spent a semester out there. And that, talk about integration. They had integrated the schools by busing. I mean, really integrated them.
Okay.
Our children were in the minority as white.
Right.
Which was, I thought, excellent. And they had very good teachers. The whole school system, which isn't very good, or hasn't been very good for quite a while, but was excellent in 1970. They were really working to bring all children
up
to standards. So.
Yeah, my own children went to a, I was a career naval officer and spent my tour before coming to Lawrence. We spent quite a bit of time at big U.S. Navy base we have out in Japan, and we have DOD school system there, and the DOD high school, my children were minority in that high school, and they had a wonderful experience, and I thought there wasn't any better way for them to really learn other cultures and be exposed to that kind of diversity, which I think is important for everybody.
Why we need it.
Yep, absolutely.
You've got to be carefully taught one way or the other. Yep.
This whole schools, getting the schools integrated, which Lawrence did to some extent by busing. Our children went to Hillcrest School, and a lot of the kids from Stauffer Place, from graduate students from other countries, went there too, so that was, I thought, very good.
Good,
but kids are, you know, if they're not told that they shouldn't accept people, they just accept them so well.
Right. Yep. Absolutely. Let me take you back again to those articles we were talking about. Was there any negative reaction? Were there letters to the editor in response to any of them? That you recall?
No reaction that I remember.
Okay.
But the realtors did have their turn. They had a big ad in the Journal World about forced housing, and that was rebutted by the local chapter of the NAACP.
Okay.
Have you seen that ad?
I have seen an ad that was actually run at the time the state was considering it, is this the one in which the realtors basically call fair housing kind of a Marxist socialist doctrine? And
65, that was probably the one.
This is the one I've seen.
I think
this was run when the state was first considering.
Now, locally.
And describes the philosophy of curbing the property-owning class is a Marxist-socialist doctrine. So they took their position pretty strongly.
Now, locally, lawyer, Don Holtz, who had been a former state senator, appeared to testify against the Lawrence Ordinance on behalf of the Lawrence Realtors Board.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you kind of recall the nature of their arguments against it? Although Fred Six gave us a very good.
I think I had a copy of the newspaper article that quoted him.
Right. Fred went into a great deal of legal detail about what their legal positions were, which he just thought were not worth very much.
right.
The other thing I want to ask you about, so the other part of this, the campaign that the Fair Housing Coordinating Committee kind of had going in parallel to the Human Relations Commission working on the ordinance, in addition to those articles, was a signature campaign. in which they published the signatures of in two different times. I think there was like 900 in one full page ad that they published, and then 300 or 400 more. So well over 1,000 signatures of people. And not only did they have the people's names, but also their addresses and the city. Mapping people have actually mapped where all those people live and found it was a pretty widespread group of people who lived all over town. And were you surprised, do you remember, at that widespread level of support? Or do you feel like, Lawrence, there was a fairly broad-based group of people who were ready for this kind of change?
I felt they were ready, yes.
Yeah. I was heartened. I don't remember being personally involved in that idea even, but so the list just appeared in the paper, and I thought, gee, this is great. They're so large.
Well, I think we signed and knew about it, but no, we didn't. We weren't among the people who got it going.
Right. And it's interesting that even, I think about 3 years before, the United Church Women of Lawrence did a similar campaign, which they worked through the churches and got about 845 signatures. So there clearly was, again, Lawrence was a pretty small town, so to get over 1,000 signatures was not insignificant at the time.
Right.
So it does show that there was a fair amount of support out there.
I think the realtors were finding themselves kind of in the minority. And I think once the ordinance was passed, which was, what, done in 6 months, it was really just, I don't remember any problems that, like, people said, I'm not going to follow this or that kind of thing. They may have said it, but you didn't read about it in the paper or hear about it.
And there didn't appear to be a big backlash in terms of letters to the editor. There were a couple of voices, but not very many that objected to the ordinance. When the ordinance in April, I don't know whether you were at the meeting of the city commission, but Fred Six presented the ordinance to the commission.
Yeah, we were there.
And everything that I can tell, the commission seemed fairly receptive, at least the majority of them. Was that your impression, that that there wasn't a whole lot of pushback? I mean, Dick Rainey even was quoted in the paper after it was presented, praising it as a great piece of work. So were you confident in the time at that time that you thought it was going to pass the city commission? Did you feel
like... Yeah, there was just one guy who was very conservative businessman downtown who... And the farthest he could go was to say, well, I don't know, I have to think about this, you know.
I probably, I was a whole lot younger then, but I was sure it would pass. I wasn't surprised that it passed.
Good.
I mean, we worked so many people worked on it. No, I think it was time. Right. I think people realized it was time.
And Fred Six kind of pointed out that really the members of the Human Relations Commission at that time, he felt, was a pretty broad and prominent cross-section of the community, and their influence on, not that that most of the city commission wasn't receptive anyway, but that just gave a little extra weight to it.
Well, and
those
kind
of people behind it.
Yeah, and I think people in the community said, accepted having a human relations committee, accepted that we needed.
Yeah. A couple other things that were sent up to the city commission at the time they were considering the ordinance was a letter from Vice Chancellor Surface, which said the university is fully supportive of this. It's in accordance with the university's housing policy, which had already, the university some years earlier had gone through its own process of finally getting around to an integrated housing policy. So the university was, administration was behind it. And then also there was a letter, I don't know if you recall, from Ted Owens, the basketball coach.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I go around the country recruiting athletes to come to KU. I tell their parents that they're coming to a wonderful town where they'll be treated fairly, and we need this, an ordinance like this, to back that up. Do you think that those types of expressions of support were influential in helping to push it through?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
It's, again, being in a university town, it did help. But certainly people have always been very enamored of KU basketball. So if people thought You know, you might not get a recruit because of this. I'm sure they would
pretty much say,
wow.
You know, housing for students really underwent a great change just since we came. When we came in 57, most of the men students still lived in private
rooming
houses. Right. There were no Daisy Field dorms at all.
But it was integrated through, wasn't the stadium housing integrated? Their housing below, underneath the stadium. I think the housing was integrated.
It wasn't initially, but it was one of the first things.
Yeah.
It became integrated. Then the big fight was whether the university would continue to allow private landlords to advertise housing on campus.
That's right.
That would not allow African Americans into that housing. And the university finally, under some pressure, finally took a position that, yes, we're not going to allow those landlords to advertise on campus.
Now that you remind me, I remind.
I think that was kind of the last fight. And Gail Sayers was actually involved in the protest related to making that change. So the athletes at KU definitely played a role in helping to bring about change.
Yes.
One thing I noted in reading the meeting minutes of all the Human Relations Council meetings or Human Relations Commission meetings, and then also I think the City Commission meetings on this issue, were that the two of you were present at every one of them. Was that just because of your involvement with this particular issue, or did the two of you normally attend those on just general issues?
No, we didn't normally.
Okay.
It was because of this.
We were very committed to this issue.
Right. I would say we were interested in others, and we did go to some other meetings, but we didn't go regularly.
Right. Now, when the City Commission held, during two different sessions, one, the proponents of the ordinance presented their case, and then later Don Holtz and I think one other realtor were the only people who showed up speaking against it at a separate session. But do you recall in the session of the proponents, people, as I recall, spoke in favor of, like, Jesse Milan, Homer Floyd, who was the director then of the Kansas Civil Rights Commission. Do you think voices like theirs, voices of people who had been discriminated against, played an important role in swaying the commission that this was the right thing to do?
I think so, yes. And do you want to say something about the Kansas Advisory Commission Committee for Civil Rights? Dick was a member of this. We
kind of regressed from the local level, and I got involved at the state level,
right,
too.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about that as well.
I was not on the one, but went to that. But first, let me say, Ruth Schechter in Kansas City was director or head of that Kansas Advisory Council for Civil Rights, and I found a copy of a letter she sent saying, thank you for sending a copy of the Lawrence Ordinance and congratulations. And this, we got something through after losing at the state level.
Right.
She was very pleased with that. She was a very good person to have directing this and just spent all kinds of time involved. I think she had come through from the Jewish, I don't know whether what organization, but I think she'd started out in that way. But yeah, you can go ahead. We've got oodles of material from the Kansas Advisory Council, and we both attended a number of the meetings.
Yeah, describe that organization and how you were involved with that.
I think we both went. George and Mandy Caldwell, who are very social-minded and involved in things, told us about a meeting in Topeka where they were going to talk about fair housing. And so we were coming right off of this hot topic in our minds. So we wanted to go to this meeting. And they had a realtor from someplace in Colorado was the principal speaker. Spoke about they'd gotten the fair housing ordinance in Colorado and what was involved. And but he seems amazed that they had been able to do it. He didn't realize that that it could be done until it got done out there. So he was kind of there to encourage us. But the executive director of the Kansas...
Carl Glatt.
Kansas Civil Rights Commission. So he was a white man and with, I would say, a very abrasive approach to things. And he was under considerable fire. And so at this meeting then, we heard black people testifying against Carl Glatt. They didn't like Carl Glatt. They wanted to get rid of him. And so this was kind of a new phenomenon to me. So after the meeting, we went to talk to their spokesman who had presented their objections to Carl Glatt. And we just said, we're just getting into this. We don't know much about it. But what if you get rid of Carl Glatt, what are you wanting? And he said, well, we have a man in mind who I think can do a very good job in that position. So that's when
Homer Floyd
came on the scene there.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's very good.
Here is a there were things about, was this constitutional too, that fair housing
ordinance, and that was probably resolved the next year when the federal fair housing law was passed. Now, I had seen a letter that I think the two of you signed to the U.S. Senator from Kansas in support of fair housing nationally. So you all were obviously looking much bigger picture than just...
By then, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, here's one, Kansas Advisory Council on Civil Rights. It's an article then from the Kansas City Star in November 2, 1966. Realtors help write Colorado housing law.
Okay.
That's kind of interesting.
And I know there was some effort, people like Glenn Kappelman and even Homer Floyd went and talked at one point to the Lawrence Realtors to try and bring them on board and get them involved in the process, like it sounds like happened in Colorado, but they tended to be resistant.
Still licking their wounds.
Right.
They're just...
On that trip to Topeka, I got acquainted with the woman who was the Fred mentioned as the chair of their local civil rights commission here in Lawrence, Mays Elma Wallace.
Right.
And I got acquainted with her on that, and she was really a remarkable individual. Yeah. I was very impressed with her.
Yeah, Fred said he got to know her very well and was thoroughly impressed with her.
I did go to those meetings. I'm just not listed as a member of the committee, and it's all kind of fuzzy to me. But I know Dick took an active part, and I know I went to meetings in Topeka with that. And Georgella Lyles was another, a black woman in Lawrence, who did quite a bit with this kind of thing. I remember Georgella well.
Yeah.
She was a good person, really good person. Yeah, Fred was really very involved with the whole thing at a time when he was establishing his own career and such, too. I'm sure he...
Right. Earlier in the conversation we talked about, I asked you about kind of if you could name some people who played kind of a prominent role in general in Lawrence and bringing about change. How about specific to the Fair Housing Ordinance? Who can you name any other key individuals who you think played an important, particularly important role in making it happen and getting the ordinance up before the before the city commission and getting it passed?
Well, we said,
or was it pretty much a kind of a group effort?
Well, I think that's true, but I think Glenn Kappelman, who was not on the Human Relations Commission.
He actually was.
Was he?
Was he? In 1967, he actually had
Okay, I didn't realize, I didn't remember that. Yeah. I would say all the people on the Human Relations Commission, Jim Owens and...
I can't think of anybody we haven't already mentioned.
Okay.
They
just didn't want to make sure we didn't leave anybody
the
out.
The thing, it just seemed to go through this, that was such a fight on the state and defeated, but locally it just seemed, you know, I think maybe partly because the state one was defeated that enough people were rather indignant about that too and just said, we'll go. Because the city commission just came along.
Right.
Of course, they'd heard from people about it, too.
Yeah. And after it passed, do you recall any particular grumbling among the local public? Or I read somewhere that some people said, well, maybe this should have gone to a referendum, that there should have been a...
Oh, well, that's always...
but do you recall there was any significant pressure at all against it, or was it pretty well accepted to the best of your recollection?
I don't think I have a clipping, but somehow I remember a report of a woman who owned and operated an apartment complex, and she objected to this on the basis, you know, private property, I can choose to associate with whoever I want or not, and he pretty much expressed that forced housing point of view that the realtors
were pushing.
Did she write a, do you remember?
She's a wife of a university professor, too.
Did she write an article? How did you hear about it? Do you remember?
That's what I can't remember now. Yeah. And I didn't find a clipping in our collection.
No, I didn't see anything in there about it.
Yeah.
I don't really remember that. They're
I don't remember her name, so I can't name names.
Right. Well, the reason I bring that up is we had looked earlier at that letter to the editor that the two of you signed some weeks after it pass, and I was wondering, do you think that was a response because there were some other negative letters about it and you were just trying to lay out the positive argument, or did you just feel like at that point the city commission deserved an attaboy for having gotten this done?
Probably both.
Some relief.
I don't really remember, but I don't think we would have heard too much about it.
Yeah, because you really, your letter to the editor both praised the fact that it passed. A couple of paragraphs you kind of summarized. Here's what's in the ordinance, just to make people aware. And
publicity. Yeah. I think that was be another thing.
Right.
Make sure people.
Good.
Some people read letters to the editors and they don't read other things.
Right.
But yeah, that there's support for this. I'm sure there were people who grumbled about it, and I'm sure there were people who own, you know, a couple duplexes and don't want this done. But there were some exceptions for duplexes, and I don't know. I think for a lot of people, the whole idea of selling your house to people, in this case, of course, to black people, was losing money. And that comes with the redlining and somebody going in and saying your property values are going to drop and that kind of thing. Financial, in other words, because a lot of people really couldn't afford to lose money. If you had enough money, you could take a stand on that way. So there again, having a law meant that...
everybody was on an equal playing field. Yeah.
That's a help.
I had one other experience about that time after it passed, but we had next door neighbors who at some point got to separating and divorcing, and so they were going to sell their house. And so I saw the woman in the driveway one day, and I walked over and I said, I just want you to know that as far as we're concerned, we'd be happy if you sold your house to the Negroes or whites, but we don't think that we wouldn't like to have discrimination like that. And the woman, her jaw dropped. She just stared at me. She never said anything ever to me again.
Interesting. But you you commented before we started the interview that, in fact, your neighborhood did become integrated. African-American families moved in after the
Yeah, a couple. They just didn't stay long because they were universities.
Right, right.
We live right near the university, just down the hill.
Yeah, you all are on Avalon.
It's Avalon, and it's a very, well, there are a number of people who aren't associated with the university, but it's at least it used to be a mostly university people because they wanted to live right close to campus, which is what we've always liked.
Right. So you all can say that you actually saw some actual change come about as a result of the ordinance.
Right.
And would you say that the neighborhood accepted these families without any
issues? Heard any problem about it.
Good.
I'm quite sure it would be accepted by the people who live there. We have we have gay people, we've had people from other countries or of other nationalities. I don't believe there's a black couple there now. I don't have as good a feeling for who all lives there as we've gotten. We've been there longer than anybody, but I would say people are neighborly, but don't have time to really neighbor. We don't have the kind of get-togethers that we once did.
Right.
And also, there are not many children right now in the neighborhood. And when they're children, that's how you get out.
Right. This may not be a fair question to ask because it asks you to kind of give me a general impression. But would you say that what happened in your neighborhood, did you have any observations that was starting to happen more broadly in Lawrence after the ordinance passed?
Neighborhoods
were starting to integrate?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So you all can say, based on your observation and impressions, the ordinance did make a difference.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I think it made a difference in attitudes. I think there are a lot of people. This is my impression. I don't have any facts really to base it. That there are a lot of people probably just waiting for something like this that were relieved or found, at least, as they went on, and people found, we did have friends, again, associated with the university, who lived not many blocks from us toward downtown, I think on Alabama, and they were I'm not sure that they owned or rented the house. I remember Thelma telling me, and she was at the high school as a counselor or something, but across the street, the woman wasn't too happy. Now, Thelma was very low-key, and she said, essentially, she overcame this with kindness. She was very friendly. She would take things over to the woman such, and came around. So some of that is getting to know people.
Absolutely. That's
one of the biggest
arguments for integration is when you get to know the people you didn't think you liked before, but then you find out they're just people just like you. Your attitude changes.
We find that underneath everybody is pretty much everybody wants the best for their family. They want a home. They want employment.
Right. Let's shift away from fair housing for just a second. And we had brought up earlier the swimming pool. In November of 67, the city finally, in a public vote, passed the bond issue to build the public swimming pool after it had failed a couple times previously. What do you think finally convinced, and I understand it didn't pass by much, but it passed, what do you think finally convinced the majority of the public that the time had come to build an integrated swimming pool and pass that bond issue?
Well, I think people were worn down, and I think the children had a lot to do with it, I suspect. insisting they wanted a swimming pool. And not only did white children wanted a bigger swimming pool, a good swimming pool. The little one they opened down south at 23rd was not very big, and we took our kids to that. We would not join a private pool, and they knew that we wouldn't, unless there was a public one. And eventually we did join one out near the West Junior High, because that's where they went and their friends were there and they could ride their bikes there.
Right.
But that was after we had the downtown public pool open. And they did go to the one downtown too. Yeah. So why it passed then? Well, I think people, issue is not going away.
Right.
There are enough people pushing for it.
And obviously the fact, as you point out, there didn't seem to be much pushback to the fair housing issue, so maybe attitudes were just starting to change.
Yeah, I can't think it was...
Yeah.
I think coming up with the money for it, I'm not sure there were too many people who were against it. There were other swimming pool things. If you didn't want your kids swimming with children of other races or nationalities, you could join a private one.
Right.
But we needed one that was available to
somebody all told the me it might have been Professor Cassad that he thought that both Baldwin and Eudora had integrated public school public pools before Lawrence did. Do you think there was any sense of pressure in Lawrence that other communities had integrated pools and we're behind?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I would think so.
Another thing I wanted to ask you is, obviously there was a lot going on nationally in that time frame, racial tensions and, of course, action at the national level. The Civil Rights Act had passed, the Voting Rights Act. Do you think that national events put pressure on people here locally, that they needed to recognize that change is coming, let's start adopting it locally because it's the right thing to do?
And it's going to come.
Right.
So I think people,
do you have that feeling that,
more and
that
more,
people
yeah.
were cognizant of what was happening around the country and feeling like it's time for us to change here too?
I think so.
And certainly a university town, again, you would have had people who were very well-read and aware of what was going on
and
nationally.
Coming from other places.
Right, exactly.
And you know, the library, I was thinking about this, we had too small a library, it was outdated, and wanted a library and pushing for a bond issue for that, which happened, as I remember, in 1970, the bond issue passed. It kind of goes along. It's, again, something our children need, a better library facility.
Right.
We all need a better library facility. There's fair housing, there's the swimming pool. The library is a little different because the library had been open to, of course, everyone. But just the idea of having a better, bigger, for the children as well as for other people. I think Lawrence was very much a town that wanted things for its children.
Good.
We're aware of this.
Right.
I think it always has been.
Now, unfortunately, even as this progress was happening in 69 and 70, Lawrence erupted in some violence, some
yes.
of it related to the Vietnam War,
yes.
but some of it also related to racial issues. Were you surprised when that happened, or did you sort of have a sense that there was kind of a lid on a boiling pot and something was going to happen at some point?
We were on my sabbatical out at Berkeley
for six months.
In the first 6 months of 1970.
When the Union burned.
And that was just the end of the violence in Berkeley. The city park bust had happened the previous fall, and things were beginning to quiet down there. So I picked up the San Francisco Chronicle, and on the front page was a picture of Lawrence police macing black students at Lawrence High.
Wow.
Ah, and people said, what's going on in Lawrence, in Kansas City?
Well, we of course, heard from some of the people here.
Yeah.
And Dick, but they were still using tear gas on campus.
Out there, yeah.
Out there. Yeah. It wasn't completely over. No, it was a very interesting time to be.
Yeah. Did it surprise you when it happened in Lawrence, or did you have a sense before you left that maybe things were kind of build that tension was building?
I had not imagined that kind of thing happening. That was a shock to me.
Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't too surprised. I wasn't anticipating it, but I wasn't too surprised because just, again, you're aware in a university town, the high school students, the younger students are aware of so many things because of that.
Actually, that's been brought up to me by a couple of people, is that it wasn't just the university, but the high school also was kind of a focal point of some racial tensions.
Yes.
Yeah. How old were your children in that time frame? They were still younger than high school.
In 69, they would have been 8 and 6 or so. Yeah, they were well below that.
So
and
you wouldn't have had any personal experience.
Out in Berkeley, they were in grade school, and they got excellent education and a very diverse setting. Teachers were diverse as well. People. And, of course, exposed to a lot of other things around there, which we thought was very good for him. And children just accept these things. I suppose if their parents have taught them otherwise, but the friends, our children, the kids they went to school with that they chose to become closer to, there was no bearing on race, it was just various races and whatever, and nobody seemed to be paying attention to what color your skin was or what your eyes looked like. And I just never heard anything about that. And I volunteered in the art classroom once a week, and so I was around the children some and such because I was very involved in art workshops and activities out there. It was such an open time. You could just participate in all kinds of things without any formal basis, really.
Right.
They also had a good anti-drug education program in Berkeley, and that was very
starting,
good.
First grade.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I'm coming close to the end of my questions. You'll be glad to know, but I want to give you the opportunity to blow your own horns a little bit. What are the two of you most proud of, the contributions you made to these groups and to these accomplishments back in that time frame?
Well, working with other people, getting other people involved to promoting the fact that we needed fair housing law, promoting integration of things, I would say, for me. The fact that you stuck your neck out. But you had, did you have tenure? Yes, by then you had tenure.
Right.
It took me quite a while, I think, to realize that the pressure that could be on people about their livelihood and such things.
Right.
Because I just didn't worry about that.
Dick, do you have any thoughts on what you are most proud of your involvement at that time?
I was just resisting the concept of personal pride. I've just got a lot of satisfaction out of doing the things that we did in connection with this, and I'm so glad it all worked out.
Right. The final question, reflecting back on how you were able to accomplish these things back then, if you were to talk to a group of young people today who wanted to know how they could bring about positive change, what would you tell them based on your experiences back then? What lessons would you pass along?
Go ahead. You dealt with young people for more years than I did.
Well, I guess I would try to modestly say this is one way to go about it, but some people don't have the temperament to do it that way. They've got to storm the Bastille, and sometimes that accomplishes things too. So, but that's not the way I like to work. In fact, in this whole fair housing thing, I felt like I was kind of working behind the scenes somewhat. I did surface here and there, but like arranging those newspaper articles, my name does not appear anywhere in any of the newspapers that carried those articles.
And not because you were afraid to put it in, but because you didn't feel it was necessary.
It wasn't.
You didn't have the standing in the community.
I didn't have
no one in the community, right, in the way these other.
As a physicist, I had no expertise. I'm entirely an avocation to meddle in civil rights affairs.
Yeah, I don't call it pride, but just feeling good that we were active in it. I was active in it, and tell people to go ahead and act on your beliefs as much as you can, but think about it.
The other thing I'd say is it can be quite exhausting, and I can't personally imagine myself involving myself in a series of issues like that over and over again, doing all this pushing through. I kind of exhausted my energy for that kind of effort.
Yeah, did the two of you get involved in anything that along those same lines later on, or was that
not to that extent?
No, okay,
not to that extent. Yeah, I think we were doing that. I have seen small, but not infants or something, but small children. You were still. Well, you were
still
working
building
on
my
research and
career, yeah.
Yeah, right. Working on the career and the teaching, which can take us,
sure,
as much time as you put in on it. And
well, you went from advocacy to just being supportive of positive development.
Yeah, I'd say I was still involved with the establishing the nursery schools and things like that, but working with that somewhat. With the whatever the league was working with it, well, for the library, we worked for getting that bond issue passed, but no, not to that extent.
Okay, well, I've come to the end of my questions. I want to give you one last opportunity. Is there anything that I haven't touched on, or any other memories you had which you really were hoping to have the chance to share? That this is your opportunity to do that, or have we covered everything you can
think
of?
Covered it.
I've covered it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time. I think the passage of the Lawrence Fair Housing Ordinance is a real testament to how a group of concerned citizens can come together kind of at the grassroots level and push for change and make it happen. So I think your involvement in that is something both of you can be very proud of.
Now, this is all preliminary. Next year will be the actual observance of
right.
the 50th anniversary.
Right. You've done... Good thing. I thought Fred gave a very good talk. Are we still on the mic?
Yes, but I can turn it off since I think we've wrapped up the formal interview.
Not that I'm going to say something that shouldn't be on the mic, but I don't think it's necessary.